The last couple of days I've been trying to introduce to you and give you an outline. I think the major principles of pure awareness practice, the framework that we need to nurture and to put into place so that we can grow into it, so that maturing process has a chance to create the environment for the maturing process to take place. It is fundamentally simple, and I try to just outline that simplicity for when you actually come to put it into practice. It is simplicity itself, and that's why a lot of us have a lot of difficulty actually seeing it. We just imagine there must be more to it than I think, you know, that I've been told that. You know, it's just got to be more complex, therefore I need to learn more and more. But it really is that simple. But because it's simple, doesn't mean to say that it's easy to put into practice. That's the paradox of it. It's the simplest thing in the world, and yet it will take every ounce of commitment in you to pull it off. And there's a nice little paradox for you. That's the reality of it. So what I like to do today is throw it open, and if people have got questions, must have thrown up lots of queries and questions, if we can spend the day maybe polishing a few little bits and pieces up, and maybe we can move into other things tomorrow, or not, as the case may be. So if anybody has any question to get us started, we'll see how we get along. And I hope, if you can, try as best you can to keep the question, the query, in the context of what we've been doing. You know, we could start talking Dharma in general and Buddhism and go wandering around the universe, which in one way is, you know, is very pleasant. But I like to try and keep it as focused as possible. So if you think your question is within that framework, feel free.
Yesterday you started talking to me about containing the energy in the body, and I just wondered if you could say a bit more about that, and also in connection with sort of a healing process.
How do you define healing?
Just a sense of coming a bit more whole.
Yeah. Well, hopefully the whole practice, is a healing process in that regard. And it's learning through containment that the healing process actually begins to. This is the healing process, is that we learn to. By containing, we embark upon the process of actually making friends with ourselves, and that of course is what needs to be healed. Is that we are not friendly with ourselves. We're very much in, for a lot of the time, very much in conflict with ourselves, in conflict with other people. But when we're in conflict with others, it's merely a reflection that we're actually in conflict with ourselves, and that's where the healing process actually takes place. Now, in terms of containment, with this particular type of practice, at least the way that I present it, that the energy, the emotional energy that I've already touched upon, is very much the crucial component, is very much at the heart of the transforming process. It is the emotional energy that transforms, and is when that transforms, that is the transforming process, and then you as a person are actually a part of that transforming process, because basically we are our emotions, and it's those emotions that get caught up and polluted with me and mine. Is the very thing that we need to focus on and bring to the heart of this practice. And the way that we do it, all right, let's look at the way that we don't do it, is that when we come into a situation, whatever it may be, one of something we feel threatened by, somebody says something, somebody does something that we feel threatened by, or we desire something, or we have an aversion to something, or we have a fear, a whole raft of things that we can, at the snap of a finger, become reactive towards, and our emotions can rise up and identify with whatever that particular scenario may be, and then the volcano erupts and we explode and go down the old familiar road of reactivity, that habit that in fact very often we can notice, but the habit is so ingrained that even when we notice it we can't stop it. It's so powerful that it just picks us up and carries us away, and we go down the old familiar road of creating difficulties for ourselves and for other people, and creating karma and creating that volition through our emotions that just keep that turning that wheel of becoming. So we just go round and round and round for the whole of our lives, making the same mistakes, falling into the same traps continually for the whole of our lives usually. And to see that it's the emotional charge, the volcano, the energy, the fire that sits underneath all of these situations that we find ourselves in, is the crucial key to transformation. Because if the fire can be transformed, if it can lose its heat and its volition and its power, it will quite naturally take all these other attachments that we have with it. They will fade because they no longer have the life force that they need to make them real. So by focusing, by appreciating this and by seeing this, we learn to focus much more on the energy, on the emotion, which again, as I've been trying to offer you, is in the body, is physical, is not mental. That emotion is in the body. And again, it demands our attention, to bring our attention, to bring our life into our body in order that we can begin to work with this energy, not try to work it out mentally, as is often what we try to do, but rather abandon that path and come back into the body, into the form, into the emotion. And when we do this, when we come back into that, awaken to that direct experience, that's what it is. It is a direct experience, a direct impact. There is no thinking. This is before thinking of good and bad, right and wrong. It is that direct impact. And this is what really characterizes this practice, is that it is a living practice. It is a direct, very, very dynamic, direct experience. We're not putting a space. We're not thinking about it. We're not putting it in categories and in boxes. We're not trying to work it out. But we're actually opening and living that direct experience. And that is very, very important to realize that. And to see that direct experience is emotion, is an emotional experience. It's physical, it is very much physical. It is emotional and it is very direct. So by seeing that we see that it's in the body, and our attention, our awareness needs then to come into the body, needs to come and to be very close to that emotion and begin to get to know that emotion, become familiar with it, rather than being carried away by it. We need to become more familiar with it. We need to become closer to it. So we learn through awareness. Awareness is the key to every aspect of practice. We learn through awareness that we need to work with the emotional fire that comes with experiences, so that when, for example, somebody presses one of our buttons and we're just about to go down that old familiar road, with our awareness — the awareness is the key, without awareness this is not possible — we can stop ourselves, we can say, no, I'm not going to do that. And that volcano, that fire that's waiting to erupt, waiting to run down a path of greed, hatred or delusion, we learn to contain. We don't suppress it, we don't push it away, we don't opinionate ourselves about it, but we learn to open up, allow it to be, give it space, give it the space that it wants, open up, but not allow it to explode and take us down the old path that we are familiar with. And learn to open to contain and learn to stay and learn to bear with these emotional experiences. Of course, are physical, and invariably they are not pleasant, but we learn to bear with, to bear. This is again such a key, such an important part of what we do, is to cultivate the ability to bear with, and we don't do that. We don't do that in our culture, in our society. We're not familiar with bearing with. When things get difficult, we are taught to find a way out of that, and we've got so many options in which we are encouraged to consider in order that we avoid and that we don't have to bear with something uncomfortable. And this becomes our habit, this becomes a part of how we live, of our makeup. And I think that's especially relevant, it's the human experience, but especially for us Westerners, because we are conditioned from an early age not to bear with, not to put up with something that we don't like. And that emotional experience isn't that, when we learn to contain that emotion, it can't be said to be a pleasant experience, because it's energy, it's emotion, and it wants to relieve itself. And now we're saying no. Now we're saying I'm going to stay with it. And this is so crucial to develop that ability to learn to stay with that experience, which is emotion, which is in the body. This is not mental, this is physical. And learn to bear with. And through time, whether it depends on what the attachment may be, whether it be seconds, minutes, hours, days, even weeks, it wants to come out, but through awareness we learn to contain and not allow it to run off and relieve itself. We learn to stay with, so that in time, because it's energy, and because energy by its nature is dynamic, it has to do something, it cannot stagnate. You can contain it, but it's eventually something has got to happen. And if it doesn't expend itself in the old habitual way, what happens is that it returns back. It's like it turns over. It returns back into its original nature before it got caught up with you and your wants, your desires, your aversions, etc. It turns back into its pure state before the pollution, which is your true nature. This is your Buddha nature. This is the Buddha. That's how close we are. But the Buddha somehow gets mixed up, and this sense of self, this sense of me arises, and then the whole thing becomes distorted and polluted, and this is where ignorance and delusion come from. And it's by learning to stay with that energy, with that emotion, that we can, if we can stay with, if we can bear with, if we can learn to carry it around in our life and live our life as humanly as possible, it will revert back into its original state. So that in time, this is not just a simple one-off process. It's the fire comes and comes through all sorts of different situations. But through time, if we can bear with that energy, bear with that emotion, eventually that fire becomes less and less and less, and the more less that becomes, the more that our sense of awareness becomes ever more present, we begin to feel much more a sense of spaciousness, a sense of not being caught by things in the same way that we used to be, our views and our opinions and the things that are so precious and so dear to us become less and less, that become more transparent, not so real and solid and so vital. That the samsaric world, which is our own creation, begins to fade. A bit like, you know, you imagine a very dirty window that's so dirty that you can't see through it, you can't see what's on the other side of the window. And it's like a polishing process where we just slowly, patiently, with commitment, and it takes commitment, and it that ability to stay with it, it's like we're slowly polishing the window. so that in time it becomes, we begin to get some little sense of what's through on the other side of the window, and we stay polishing and we polish and we polish until the time comes when we can see clearly, so clear that we don't even actually notice the window anymore because it's so clean. We're just taken by the view on the other side of the window, so that window in fact is still there, but it's so transparent that it no longer obscures the view. This is what happens as we enter the transforming process. We're actually in a position of cleaning, of polishing. Although, as with all examples, they do have their flaw, and actually there isn't a person who does the polishing. But that's the principle of how it works, and that principle, to use a slightly different perspective, is that what we're doing there, what we're actually doing, and this is something again so crucial to realize, is that when we're learning to contain that world that we've created, that we've become a part of, that we're so reactive within, that we create that karma, that we create that volition, that emotional volition, that karmic volition that creates that paticca samuppada, that turns that wheel of becoming, that has so much power, has so much strength, that just keeps turning and turning and turning, that even when we die, that wheel does not stop turning and another form is created out of it. That's how powerful it is. And to see that what we're actually doing when we are willingly not buying into what is our karmic habits, the things that give me self-identity, the things that make David real and alive, the things that reaffirm that I exist, I want, I don't want, I like, I don't like, is all about me reaffirming me. That whole process of self that gives the volition to that whole world that we create. That what we do is that through awareness, we're beginning to say, no, I'm not going to participate. I'm not going to partake of that wheel anymore. I'm just going to leave that wheel alone, and I'm just going to let it slowly lose its volition, lose its strength, until it slows down and slows down. And what we're doing there, for the first time, these things that we bought into, these things that we've become reactive towards, these things that we want to possess and want to run away from, we begin to see more and more that actually all these things are a part of me, and they are all a part of the relationship that I have with myself, and the dualistic relationship that I create with myself of like and dislike, right, wrong, good, bad, pure, impure, and on it goes. These opposites that seem to bounce off of each other, and we sometimes we're on this side, and sometimes we're on. Sometimes I like myself, sometimes I don't like myself, sometimes I like other people, and sometimes I don't like them. I'm good, I'm bad. I'm a good practitioner, I'm a bad practitioner. I'm a pure person, I'm an immoral person. On and on and on and on it goes. Like a table tennis ball going across a table, ping pong, ping pong, ping pong, like this all the time, never ending. For the first time, we're not going to engage in that reactivity. What we're going to do is that we're beginning to open up to ourselves, and rather than bounce off of ourselves and create space, we're actually beginning to open up to ourselves and say yes to ourselves. And I'm not going to be reactive anymore. I'm going to open up to that which I've always reacted against. I'm now going to say yes. I'm not going to say I'm good, I'm bad, I'm right, I'm wrong. I'm just going to open up. And in that opening up, that volition, emotional volition, that keeps that duality in place begins to fade. And those two halves, if you like, in a particular situation, those two halves begin to come back together. And what we're actually doing there, maybe for the first time in our lives, is that we're actually learning to be friends with ourselves, because that conflict isn't with so-and-so out there. that conflict is with me, and it's the conflict that I've created, that I've somehow managed to convince myself that actually it isn't me, it's that person out there. And we see more and more that all of the conflicts that we have, all of the dualities that we have, not necessarily conflicts, but all of the dualities that we have, are all created by me, and all serves to create that split, that lack of integration, where we are in one side or we're in the other side. And for the first time, we're beginning to open up and we're beginning to say yes to ourselves. We're actually beginning to accept ourselves and say, yes, this is the way I am. I'm not saying it's good, I'm not saying it's bad, but this is the way I am. And I'm going to open up to what is me, and I'm going to embrace me and become one and reunite with that which has been separate. And that is the fundamental reality of practice. It is a process of healing. It is a process of healing the conflicts that we have that reflect in our body, that show itself in so many different ways that somehow we manage to project it outwards, that it's not me, that it's you, to see more and more that actually it is me. There is nothing other than me. And they're learning to open and embrace and welcome back that which is what is split away, so that all those fragmentations actually come back, slowly come back into the whole. That's the process of making friends with ourselves. And this is very much the dharmic and the very profound way of healing ourselves. And once that friendship is truly in place, then we will, not only we will be happy, but we will be very spacious and very free. And also, very interestingly, that on a just bringing it down onto a physical level, talking about healing, you will find that probably at least 80% of the ailments that you've experienced in your life will no longer be there. That's a very interesting observation.
What do you mean by the ailments?
Sorry?
What do you mean by the ailments?
Ailments. All the different ailments that we get. How many of those are very intimately connected with our mental states? And when we heal our mental states, because mind and body are not two. However much we may think and however much we want, we, for those that can read the body, we are completely exposed, and our body shows our minds, and vice versa, because they are not two. The more you understand, the more your insight into the way things are, you will see that mind and body, they are the same. They're not different. It's only delusion that's made a space, that's made this separation. And when we make that separation, we create disharmony, we create imbalance. And when we're when the balance is not there, this is the environment where things can start to go wrong with the body. When the body's in balance, when the mind's in balance, the body will be in balance. And then all we're exposed to then, they're just the natural things of coming to be and ceasing to be, of which, you know, we're all going to get sick and we're all going to die. That's the natural process. But in the meantime, most of the stuff that we get in our lives need not be. Most of it is our own, to do with our own relationship with ourselves. So there's a healing both from every angle.
How do you know when you're containing, and how do you know when you're suppressing?
Well, that's something that you have to play with. You have to experiment. As I think I said on the first day, bring a sense of playfulness into what you're doing. Don't take it so. You've got to get it right. You've got to, you know. That's all part of our relationship with ourselves. That, you know, I've got it wrong again, I'm doing it wrong, this, you know what I mean? Bring that intensity. Because you're experimenting with something that you've never done before. And therefore you're going to make mistakes. You've got to learn, like a child learns. You learn, and you learn through play, and you learn through... not. I don't mean that in a frivolous way. I mean it in a way that you are prepared to make mistakes. Yeah, not to think that you must get it right, but think that, well, I'm going to play with it and I'm going to do my best and I'm going to, you know, I've got that commitment, but I'm not necessarily going to get it right all of the time. And when you find that you get it wrong, you don't start saying, ah, there you go, you're rubbish, you don't know what you're doing. You got to get it right and stuff. That's all part of the thing that we're trying to unravel, trying to get to. That's all part of your relationship with yourself. And it's very subtle, but... You will grow into it. You'll become familiar. Again, what needs to be established is awareness. And you begin to see what is suppression and what is containment. If you find that, oh, I'm containing, and what you're doing is, I don't like the look of that, and somehow you're sort of sidestepping it, maybe in a very subtle way, but you're clearly not facing into it and opening. You'll know. I mean, you may, you know, this is subtle, and as I say, you play with it, and event, you know, you get to know when you're opening and saying yes to that experience, yes, like a mirror. You don't have an opinion, but you reflect, you know everything that's in front of you. You know the difference between that, and you know, don't want to be bothered with that one, maybe. Maybe the next one would be a little bit better. You know, as I say, if you experiment, you get to know. And this is where honesty, you can play games with everybody else in the world, but you yourself know when you're honest with yourself. And do your best. And some things will come round that you can't open up to. It's too big for you. And that's okay as well. To know that, say, well, I can't be dealing with this. This is too big, and that's fine. Don't then turn around and say, God, there you go again. You're useless, so and so. You can't do anything right, can you? You come up against something, you run away like a little coward. That's the worst thing you can do, because all you're doing there is reinforcing the very thing that you're having difficulty with. That's throwing fuel on the fire. This is the subtlety of what we're doing, is that. You have to accept that you're not perfect, and you never will be perfect, but you can always do your best. And nobody's ever asking any more than that. And that's very, very important, because that is fundamental to the relationship that you have with yourself. That is absolutely crucial. And it's a trap that we all fall into, that we then create that reactivity to the, you know, I can't do this, I'm no good, or... whatever, it's all your fault, it's all blah, 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 blah. That's just reinforcing the fire, that's throwing fuel on the very fire that we're trying to leave alone, that will burn itself out if we don't throw fuel on. And we got to learn that. That goes against everything that we've learned in our lives, because we've been in that reactive mode all the time. And it's so ingrained within us that half the time we don't even think about it. We're not even aware of it. We just do it. And we think, well, that's, you know, what's that got to do with anything? That is it. That is exactly what it's about. It's your relationship with yourself in all circumstances. This is what this is all about. And that's the healing process, is learning to declutch from throwing more fuel, still more fuel. And if we just... you know, reflect on ourselves, everybody in this room, we all do it. This is what we do, and this is why we're all trapped in samsara, because we're throwing fuel on the fire. And this is why we're going like this. This is why that wheel of becoming is just going round and round and round and round and round and round, because this is what we're doing. It's all to do with our relationship with ourselves. We're just throwing fuel on that fire. And this is what we have to awaken to. This is why it's called awakening. We awaken to the process, to the way it is, and through that awakening we learn through time, through skill, through commitment, not to throw fuel on the fire, but leave it alone. But do it in a skillful way. not enough force. And I think this is a feature, a reflection of the middle way. It is not, I'm not going the other way, but learning to gently work with it.
When you say the contained energy reverts to its true nature, its Buddha nature, part of that process would be actually communicating with greater skill those things that have made you reactive, those people, those situations.
Yeah.
Going back to them at some point.
Yeah. Of course, this doesn't turn, we don't turn into a zombie because, you know, I'm containing and I'm, and somebody's what, standing, well, come on, speak to me. I can't, I'm practicing the Dharma, don't speak to me. No, it's not like that at all. This is all part of the playfulness, the learning that balance, the learning to work with things, is that we do our best to retain the edge of, you know, whatever that attachment is, but then as best we can, again, only as best we can, and we can't do any more than that, be as skillful as you can within that situation. If it is talking to people, to talk, you know, to be as human as you can. You may be absolutely raging inside and you want to bite their head off, but you're learning, you're retaining your awareness, you're retaining that whole familiar habit, and you're trying to communicate, you're trying to do the best that you can within that. And you know, we all know, as certainly as adults, we all know the difference between right and wrong, and you know what's appropriate, what's skillful and unskillful. We don't need to be taught that. We know that, and it's to do your best to be skillful. But it is part of the learning. It is a part of the process. It's a part of turning the wagon around, if you like, from being so much like this to slowly turning it around to actually what we're becoming is true human beings. That's all we're doing. We're becoming true rounded human beings, and all the innate qualities that we've all got, that we, so many of them we've covered over and we've lost. I don't believe that we create any of those qualities that many of us aspire to, many of us would like. I believe they're all there anyway. This is an expression of our true nature, our Buddha nature, our heart that is unsullied when it's free from all of those restrictions. Those human qualities are a natural expression. They're there anyway, and it's for us to learn to work and to nurture and allow them to grow, allow them to show themselves, not create them, because who's the one who's going to be creating? And if you're the one that's going to create all these virtues, I think it's pretty much a guarantee you're going to turn yourself into a monster. It's to allow those innate qualities that I believe are in all human beings, allow them to flower, allow them to come up. And it's, we just have to, we do our best in all situations. We just simply do our best, and we know if we're doing our best or not. Nobody can, you know, nobody else can make that judgment. And this isn't a straight line. If it were a straight line, we could just buy a book, read it and do it. We wouldn't have to come all the way to Scotland in the middle of winter, spend all our money, get wet and cold and all the rest of it. We could all be in more pleasing climates. But the fact is, you know, if somebody did write a book, we can't just pick the book up and do it. We got to work with it and play with it. It's life, it's living, it's emotion, it's life itself. And life doesn't go in straight lines. Life doesn't have any lines. And we, as I keep saying, we have to learn to play with it. And with that lightness, with the middle way, this is where that change then can become, it becomes possible. The true change, the real change, which isn't a self-centered change.
I agree with you about learning to be aware of your own aversions. There are people that I are almost totally dominated by others and allow others to run their lives for them, how do they help themselves? We've got into the habits of just allowing others to make decisions on their behalf.
Well, first of all, they're going to have to want to change, aren't they? Maybe they don't want to change. Maybe they like to be. Maybe they feel secure when they feel so insecure they can't make their own decisions, so they leave it to somebody else. That person's never going to come to places like this. It's because you're going to want to change. You're going to want to do something about your condition that motivates you. And that's knowing dukkha. And that's what will awaken you to the spiritual path, not necessarily Buddhism, but it will awaken you to the path of where you want to actually do something about it, as it were, get to grips with it, want to change. If you don't have that desire, which patently obvious that most people in the world don't, they're perfectly happy running around in circles and doing whatever they're doing, and not even aware. They don't have that sort of awareness where they think that there is a way out, as it were. At least they're not motivated to do anything about it. And if that's the case, well, that's the world, isn't it? Nothing you can do about that.
As somebody who cares about these people, it makes me very sad.
Yeah, sure. No, I agree with you.
And I feel like I want to rush in.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that you have to be very careful of, and I agree with you, because you know you found a way out of this, and you can see people actually, you know, creating so many difficulties for themselves, is that you're never going to save the world. If you think you're going to save the world, you're going to create a lot of problems for yourself. This is samsara, and it's the way it is, and most of it is, you know, what it is. There are paths out of it. There are paths where this can go into change, and that's the great liberation. That's the liberation that the Buddhism talks about, and other spiritual disciplines, paths talk about. There is a way of dealing with it, a way of changing, but it's you've got to go to it. You've got to want to do it, and I think your contribution with the world in general is to be an example. Is by working on yourself, people begin to see that change. People begin to see that you're different to what they are, that you don't seem to be caught in the same sort of stuff. It makes them inquisitive or not. Maybe they don't see it. Some do, some don't. It's to be an example. I don't think it's in the spirit of Buddhism, it's certainly not in the history of Buddhism, to go around and knock on people's doors and say, I've come to save you. Buddhism doesn't go down that path. And that's why in 2,500 years there's never been a war in its name. It has that quality where it is paradoxical, where so many can say that it's very selfish because you are looking at yourself, you're trying to change yourself, it's your priority is to work with yourself. Well, you know, you have an example of a man that actually went and tried to work on himself and discover the way that he is and why the world is the way that he is. And he went off and through his own efforts and through his own innate ability discovered, he found the answer just by working on himself. In fact, he was on his own most of the time, the Buddha. He was on his own most of the time. And he suffered and he went through and he discovered the way out. And then after he caught his breath, he came back and he just started talking to his friends, didn't he? What did he do? He didn't get up on Big Sam's soapbox. He didn't go on the local radio station. He just started speaking to his friends. But the power of that message of his own understanding, 2,500 years later, here we are sitting in this room, in Scotland, trying to aspire to what he aspired to. That's just one man on the other side of the planet, just being with himself, working on himself, working it through. Oh, what a selfish man he is. But look what he done. Look what he done. And done with peace. didn't go around and start getting older people saying, you must follow my way. If you don't follow my way, I'll cut your head off. I'll blow you up. I'll put bombs on myself and I'll go there and blow you all up because you don't believe what I believe in. That's the power. Never underestimate that power of self-realization, what it does. It can look so selfish, and yet when it matures, wow, it can do so much. But it does it in a skillful way, in a human way. And I think it's very wonderful. So, but you know, on your immediate sort of experience, all you can do is, you know, you can chat to people, you can be, you know, a little bit circumspect about things, but I don't think you push things in people's faces, especially us Western people. We react against that. And you do have to accept the fact that, you know, this is the realm that we live in, and this realm is about suffering. And if you don't see suffering, you must be pretty blind. And none of us avoid it. Even the Buddha didn't avoid suffering. Even when he was a Buddha, his body got poisoned and he became ill and went through all of that. Even a Buddha, that's the nature of this realm. It's unavoidable. But we can work with all of that, and maybe we don't have to come back to it then. Possibly. Hopefully.
I guess I know from myself that although I very much liked the direct mindfulness practices when I first came on to Buddha, it made quite a difference to me to be practicing Satipatthana and to be a strong Sangha situation, sort of communication as well. And I was thinking what you're saying about having to sort of really meet our emotions and what you're saying about containing them and everything. Thinking it does take quite a lot of probably basic self-esteem maybe to decide to do that. And I guess for myself, I know that I've sort of built that up over a period of time using practice like Metabarbon and stuff. And I guess sort of having more sense of confidence in my own heart, that I can actually hold aspects of myself that in the past I would not have dared face. I was wondering if you reckon that doing just what you call here, you call pure awareness, but just whether just doing that by itself, for instance, really is kind of enough.
It's enough, yeah. Well, our relationship with ourself is very, very important. If we are really alienated from ourselves, this practice does become highly questionable. There has to be a degree. We may not all agree with this, but actually we do have a reasonable enough relationship with ourselves to sort of get this thing going, as it were. If it's really out of kilter, then it becomes highly questionable. That's true. And something like metta, I mean, this is how it was, you know, metta meditation was, from my understanding, was actually created by the Buddha for that reason, for people that do have a relationship with themselves that isn't harmonious enough for them to get started. So it's a way of developing that positive relationship with themselves. And of course it applies today in equal Well, even more so with us Western people, because I think compared to Eastern people, we definitely do not like ourselves. Mm. We do carry such an incredible burden of self, the like of which actually never existed in the East. It doesn't exist with Eastern people. They don't have that sort of alienation with themselves. Mm. Hence, it's hardly ever spoken about in Buddhism, because it was never applicable. And yet, for us Western people, it's probably the most important thing to get in place. So metta is a very skillful way of developing that. But beyond that, it is, you know, traditionally possible to sort of dive in straight with this practice, and it has been done for a long time. But if it isn't going to be possible because of that alienation, then you can't do it. Then you have to do something like metta, which will help to nurture that relationship with yourself, and then you can come to it in the future. And the great thing about learning metta bhavana, and this ties in with all other practices that you've pursued, whether it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 or whatever the number is these days that people carry around with them. This type of practice, when it is pursued in its true spirit, in and of itself, is just one of all-embracing openness, inclusivity. And to see, because it doesn't have a created structure, and to actually see it for what it is, what this, another way of describing this openness, this inclusivity, this awareness, is that it is shunyata. It is emptiness itself. It is shunyata. And shunyata is not an object, is not a thing. And it can never be a thing. But the wonderful characteristic, shall we say, of shunyata, although it is not a thing and it's never touched by anything, it actually embraces all things. So it has two ways of how it can be used. The pure way, the direct way, is just to have that spirit of openness and to make that the bedrock of your practice and have nothing else. But what can happen, especially with us Western people, and especially talking about something like metta, we can find ourselves in a bottleneck where something just comes and sits in front of us and just says, well, look, I'm sorry, I'm not going anywhere, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to make it very difficult for you. And that's usually, you know, it could well be some relationship with yourself or relationship with somebody, something from the past that comes and just sits in front of you and says, well, I don't care if you are doing pure awareness, mate, you ain't going nowhere, I'm just going to sit here and look at you, and there you are. And so you become locked in, and however much you stay with that and you wait for that to go into change, it doesn't, because it's something very heavy and something very deeply ingrained. Then because this spirit of openness, this awareness, this so-called pure awareness, this shunyata, because it's non-specific, it's non-dogmatic, it's all-inclusive, therefore it is allowable, as it were, to bring a skillful means in to help you with a particular problem. So you could bring metta as this is what's so crucial here, as a means to an end. It's a tool that you need to use in this particular situation that you've got. You can bring it, you can bring up your experience of practicing it, you can use it to work with whatever that may be. Always in the knowledge that this is a tool that you're using, but you're always still aspiring to that openness, that all-inclusivity. But you're picking up this tool and you're using it in this particular situation. And when you feel as though it's done its job, then let it go and then come back to this. Now, because the practice is one of... is emptiness, is shunyata, is not an object in itself. By its very nature, by the very fact of what it is, it cannot, it is literally impossible to clash with any other practice, because it is not an object. It cannot. Only an object can bump into another object. Only an object can obstruct another object. If there's only one, it can't hit anything. It can't be obstructed. So if you truly understand what this practice is about, if you understand its nature, its essence of shunyata, of no thing, then any practice can be brought and used in conjunction with it, because that spirit of openness and spaciousness will always enhance any form of Dharma practice, will always help to support and enrich any form of Dharma practice. That sense of awareness that unites all practices, because all practices are ultimately about awareness. By bringing that vast inclusiveness to even those specific practices, will help to support, to balance, to enrich whatever it may be. And that's why this practice is universal, why it can be transported. You can take it to, I don't, as long as it's a bona fide, Buddhist practice, Dharma practice, not one that you made up yourself, that I don't know about, but any form, including your sadhanas, any form of samatha, vipassana, the whole raft that's at our disposal in Buddhism, not just one tradition, I mean all the traditions, you gather them all up, there's a whole raft of them. Any one of those can be brought to this spaciousness, and it will never ever interfere. It cannot, it is impossible. If it interferes in any way, creates any doubt, confusion, then you need to look at yourself and you need to look at your understanding of what you're doing, because it is emptiness, it is shunyata, and shunyata cannot create conflict. This is why it is the universal practice. This is why it can embrace everything. And this is what makes it so wonderful and so undogmatic, that actually if you do need to use another tool in your practice because you've just got so stuck with something, by all means you can evoke that tool, use that tool, but see it as something that you've evoked for that situation, and when that situation goes into change, let it go. And even then, while you're engaging with it and working with it, remind yourself, always come back to that openness, so that it's supporting, it's helping. And this to me is what's so wonderful, and I really cannot for the life of me understand why it seems to be such a problem with some people. And all I can say is that they don't understand it. They do not understand it. They do not know what shunyata is. If they knew what shunyata was, they wouldn't be in conflict with it. That's my opinion. But it can be very, very threatening. Because it doesn't have anything to hold on to, anything to say, this is Buddhism, this is this practice. Something that, you know, we can create, that we can put in a box. This is Dharma, this is how it works in the system. When you take all that away from some people, it evokes that insecurity. But once you understand it, it takes care of all insecurities. It's just something truly wonderful.
But it's people appear to be in conflict with it because it needs to be seen in the context of what they've learnt already. So, you know, what you just said about metta, for example,
they want to put it they want to put it in a box like everything else is put in a box. And I don't mean that in a bad way. You know what I mean? It's an object. It's a thing, and we have all these different objects that we all link together. And this has got to be another one. This has got to be put in a box so that it can be linked up and be a part of that sort of family of links.
I'm not quite sure what I mean, but something about... well, you explained it very well when you talked about metta. You know, because that's my experience of metta, that, you know, it starts to become this inclusive...
Mm.
You know, I start to tune into that. Not put that very well, but... It's more that perhaps... I think, well, what I'm trying to say is that what you said about metta answered a question which otherwise could have been confusing, because I also came to the Dharma with a lot of self-view, negative self-view, and there's no way that I could have a sense of touching the earth.
Mm.
Not only to do with that view, but to do with feeling that I was worthy to sit there.
Sure.
And so in a way I can see that I'm here now and I'm able to take this teaching and I can also see the seeds of this openness in all of the practices that I've been doing. But I don't think I would have felt worthy enough to take it on or something.
It's a very it is a very skillful tool that's helped huge numbers of people, and it's a very good argument that most Westerners should actually practice it, because we do have that negative view of us. We do carry this heavy burden of self, and that's invariably a negative burden. Well, it is a burden by if it were something positive, it wouldn't be a burden, would it? Mm. And that's what most of us, that's what characterizes the Western makeup. That's where apparently the Dalai Lama, he didn't, you know, being a Tibetan coming from Tibet, he had no notion of this. He had a conference in the mid 90s with lots of teachers, and for the first time this came up, teachers were actually talking about this burden of West. He had no notion. Somebody had to whisper in his ear for about 10 minutes to try and give him some sense that Westerners actually carry a burden, because Easterners don't do that. And yet for us, it's the biggest block. It's the thing that sits there. It's the major thing that we have to address. And yet for Eastern people, it's non-existent. That's why it's not in. That's why you don't read about it in books and in scriptures, because they don't have to mention it, because it's not there. It's not an issue for them.
Mm-hmm. What is quite interesting about metta-bhava is that sometimes we can start, if we've got a history of doing a particular practice, like a metta-practice, you can actually start using that to bolster up your
lack
of self-esteem.
Ah, well, exactly.
And actually, so it's like, oh, my God, I can't do better, you know, I can't finish myself, I can't finish for that person. And actually, at that point, then, here in the pure awareness practice, can actually cut through that, and you can suddenly get a sense, oh, yeah, everything's okay, and that can be a huge relief.
Mm.
So it's kind of like you sort of need all of it, don't you?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the danger, I mean, there's dangers whichever path, you know, that's part of the package that we take on, is that there are always dangers that we can get it wrong, and one thing about a conceptual thing like that is that we can, you know, it's a finger pointing to the moon.
Mm.
And we can mistake the finger for being the moon, and we can get so caught up by that we actually miss the whole point. And that's the great danger of a conceptual practice, is that we miss we take it for being the thing as actually being a pointer. And that's the great danger with that. And that's something that's avoided with this sense of spaciousness, with pure awareness, is that actually, assuming you got it right, there isn't anything to hold on to. And that can be really quite freaky, and that's something that a lot of people can't understand, is that there isn't anything to hold on to. And that's why, with this particular type of practice, you can only do it, certainly for the first few years, in conjunction with a teacher. Because you don't have any reference points, you don't have things to hold on to. You need to be guided to to the point where you can actually be let go of, and you can then maybe carry on your own. But actually, you know, Buddhist history will show you that you can't actually pick this up and practice it on your own. You'll get it wrong. But once it's in place, it will embrace everything. We've come to the end of our time for today, so thank you.